Track 12, Intervention Techniques. Now let's look at the healing experience, first for Mary and then for a client I'll call Lynn. Let's see how the healing experiences of Mary differ from those of Lynn. When asked to describe the healing experience, here is a summary of what Mary stated through several sessions. 1. Talking to healthcare professionals who believed me and wanted to help in the best way for my process of healing. 2. My own personal ways of healing myself, which were being in nature, telling myself healing thoughts, doing some of the things I used to love doing and was good at, staying in a relationship with a loving man, even though my difficulties presented themselves. 3. Telling my friends and family about it, having one close friend with whom I could share details of the abuse and the intense feelings about the mental health professional. My friend believed me even when I found it unbelievable myself. 4. Knowing that life is good. 5. The fifth point Mary stated in her healing process was looking at the work relationships that intimidated me and seeing how this was related to the abuse and getting help to work through it and do some damage control. 6. Feeling like I'm moving on in my life. Now let's look at a second client, Lynn. Lynn is a social worker who was sexually abused by her therapist, and this is what she wrote about her healing process, and you can see it's quite a bit different than Mary's. First of all, she states, leaving her subsequent therapist when she realized that he did not believe that she had been abused. Second, finding another therapist who believed her and who arranged for some very practical cognitive and biofeedback treatment for Lynn's severe insomnia. Have you used cognitive and biofeedback treatments with your insomnia clients? Third, moving to a new community. Now granted, for some clients the geographic cure may not be the best, but this seemed to be part of Lynn's healthy healing process. 4. Making an ethics complaint to the abusive therapist professional organization. Now keep in mind, this was a social worker who had been abused. 5. Getting involved herself in a committee dealing with ethics complaints. 6. Addressing conferences about sexual abuse by mental health professionals and teaching about the sexual abuse boundary power imbalance. 7. Receiving support from colleagues. Here's the therapy I use with victims of sexual abuse. Victims of abuse who have sought me out or who have been referred have already learned of my therapy experience in this area. This reduces, but certainly does not eliminate, the anxiety and distrust that abuse survivors feel about staying in therapy with another mental health professional, especially if the sexual abuse has occurred by a mental health professional, as mentioned earlier. Some abuse victims or survivors, whichever term you prefer, are so anxious at first, so scattered and fragmented in their presentation, that I find it hard to get a clear idea of their exact concerns at this point in time. Their fragmentation often comes from an inability to trust. As you work with abused clients, you might recall a specific client at this time. Think back to their issues regarding trust. The steps involved in your client assessing about your trustworthiness may be as follows. Awareness of your client's process of assessing your trustworthiness may assist you in developing treatment strategies. So here are 5 concepts that may be going through your abused client's mind. 1. Gathering information, including your 6 senses and gut reactions as references. A question the client might ask herself is there someone whose opinion I respect with whom I can check my perceptions and who can help me sort out the information about this person? So as you have an abuse survivor come to you for therapy, do they need to go through a step of gathering further information about you? 2. Forming an opinion, a hypothesis, or a guess about you as a therapist. Questions the client might ask herself are, can I devise a test whether this person is caring and trustworthy? Is there some small step I can take towards trusting this person that will not be too costly to me to help me to judge this person's trustworthiness? 3. Testing their opinion, or watching to see whether your opinion matches the person's belief in real life. And a very graphic example of this are ones that I've stated where those abused by mental health professionals had a very difficult time finding a mental health professional that would take them seriously, not be avoidant, and believe their allegations. A question the client may be asking themselves as they're testing their opinions about you are, am I, to use a psychosocial term, overgeneralizing from my trauma experience to the present in my relationship with the new therapist? 4. Revising their hypothesis or guesses as a result of new information. Now, questions the client might ask herself or himself might be, what did I learn about this new therapist? If this person has disappointed me, does this mean that he or she is not to be trusted at all, or that there are additional areas where this person is not to be trusted? If so, what are those areas? For example, if you're ill and have to cancel a session, this might red flag for you with your abused clients that trustworthiness may need to be reestablished in the next session. Repeating the process as necessary. As you know, gaining perspective refers to individuals expanding the frame of reference by which they judge events themselves and others. This expanded frame of reference facilitates seeing an event in a broader vista by applying a form of a measurement. Individuals can obtain a more relative concept of magnitude, seriousness, and duration when they do this. In contrast, people who have lost perspective think in absolute terms, as you know, as though the present instance is of utmost importance and will go on forever. At first, I concentrate on creating a safe environment and making sure that the victim knows that there are firm boundaries. Some victims whose abuse happened in a private office after the secretary left say they feel very reassured by coming to a clinic setting where there always are other people about. In the early sessions, I ask the client to give me as much as they can about their life story, including family background, and I assess symptoms of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, or other problems. Sometimes referral, as you know, for a medication evaluation is useful, particularly in this first phase of therapy, for instance, if the client is very depressed. I feel giving information about PTSD is important. I always make a point to emphasize that therapy is a collaborative endeavor, that the client is the best expert regarding themselves, and that my role is more of a catalyst than as a director. And I find with victims or survivors of abuse that this role as teammates rather than me being one up or the director seems to be most useful, since in the past they perhaps have given all their power away to their abuser who represents an authority symbol. As you know, post-traumatic stress disorder is a normal reaction to an abnormal amount of stress. However, I feel it is important for the client to know that given enough stress, anyone can get PTSD. Now, to drive this point home to the client, I find the use of the following story helpful, and you might ask yourself to explain PTSD to a client. What method do you use? I often give the following example to my clients. And perhaps you might evaluate my method of explaining PTSD as it compares to the method you use to explain PTSD to your clients. During the Second World War, some soldiers with exemplary records of mental health and family stability developed PTSD after prolonged combat exposure. It was concluded that 200 to 240 days in combat would break even the strongest soldier. Many studies showed that the best protection against the development of PTSD in wartime was the presence of supportive close buddies. However, this kind of support is often absent for children or adults who are sexually abused or abused physically. Now, is this example of PTSD a tool you might gain from this home study course as you use with your next PTSD client or patient? As you know, the person with PTSD often alternates between an intrusive phase of re-experiencing the trauma and a phase of numbing and avoidance when the person tries to bury the memories. A person with delayed onset PTSD may be symptom-free, as you know, for months or years. Now, some see this as a very prolonged phase of numbing or avoidance. The person then is propelled out of the symptom-free phase and into the intrusive phase by life changes or stresses or by triggers or reminders of the original trauma. Although use of the diagnosis has been criticized and seen as a way of pathologizing the client and medicalizing a normal response to a traumatic event, I found in my practice, as mentioned earlier, that survivors welcome being told that such an entity as PTSD exists. And many, of course, have heard about it from the media. The client finds it's comforting to know that their frightening perceptions and unpredictable emotions are totally normal in view of the disastrous and intrusive nature of the ordeal they have suffered. Mary experienced at least three episodes of delayed onset PTSD, and here they are. Number one, the first occurred when she first started therapy with a therapist immediately following the abusive incident. And the second was when she was remembering the sexual abuse of her father. She continued to have some symptoms of PTSD on and off. She was often tense and irritable, lost weight, had nightmares, and suffered terrible insomnia, often staying awake until 3 or 4 a.m. The third episode came much later and was precipitated by increased work stress. As abuse survivors tell their story, I found, like you probably have found, it is key to show I understand, accept, and support their feelings of betrayal and anger. The next phase is they begin to grieve for what has been lost as a result of their abuse and the after effects. In Mary's case, the abusive encounter at first hindered and then terminated the therapy she needed when she first went to a mental health professional. Mary felt she lost touch with the person that she had been before the abuse started. In this stage, Mary was consumed with anger and wanted revenge. Some abuse survivors decide to make a report to the police, a licensing authority, or embark on a civil suit. Because of the re-traumatizing nature many survivors experience with these systems, I help them to face realistically the pros and cons, and if possible and appropriate, put them in touch with a survivor who is knowledgeable about the legal system. In addition to recalling the abuse and grieving, clients need to understand how the abusive experience is affecting their current behavior, attitudes, feelings, and relationships. Previous issues, problems, and family difficulties that occurred before the abuse may need to be addressed, as you know. Remembering and mourning alone are not enough to repair the damage that they may have sustained. Question 12. What is one key in working with a client who has been abused by a therapist?